Okay, I'd like to call the meeting to order. And first thing on the agenda, we do need to approve the minutes from January 27th. Would anyone like to approve the name? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move to approve the minutes of January 27th.
Representative Drazkowski moves that we approve the minutes from January 27th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and minutes are approved. Now today we're, I guess it's disease day here today. We're going to be talking about bovine tuberculosis, chronic wasting disease, and the VHS. And we're going to be starting off our discussion today about bovine TB. And I think there will be a lot of useful information here about how this disease was handled and I shouldn't say taken care of yet, we've certainly gotten out ahead of this disease, and I think the DNR and the Board of Animal Health deserve a great deal of thanks for what they've done. It's something that affects the area of Minnesota that I'm from, in northern Minnesota. It didn't come directly into my area, but certainly had the potential to. And we did have a good example of what not to do, I think, in Michigan, where it did get out of control, I think we learned some valuable lessons from that and got out ahead of it as a result. So with that, I would like to, first of all, invite Joe Martin from the Department of Agriculture. If you would want to step forward and Dr. Bill Hartman from the Board of Animal Health also joining them. And if you could state your name for the record, please. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, it's good to be here. My name is Joe Martin. I serve as the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And early April, I assumed the responsibilities as the state bovine TB coordinator as many things ramped up, as many of you are aware of, which basically meant that it's helping to coordinate all of the agencies in their response, because there was many different agencies responding to this. I have today with me Dr. Hartman with the Board of Animal Health. He'll talk a little bit on the cattle side of things, of what's been happening, and also Dr. Carstensen with the DNR to talk about the deer reduction efforts, which I know many of you may have interest in. I'll be brief and just sort of provide a context, a little historical, how we got to this point, so you know where we're at and where we're going. And I guess I'd just say that, it's been a very busy year, but it has been a successful year. Many of the strategies laid out by the legislature, I think, were good, and that we were successful in implementing them. Just to take a step back in a historical perspective of dealing with TB, we struggled with bovine tuberculosis in the state. It was pretty much endemic in the early 1900s. It was very prevalent in the dairy cattle and also in the human population. Up until about around 1976, when Minnesota achieved TB-free status. We enjoyed that status until 1995. And in 2005. In 2005, we had a herd found in Roseau County, and the herd was found through regular slaughter surveillance. An animal that was slaughtered at a Green Bay, Wisconsin processing facility was found, which sort of set all of this in motion. We looked for additional herds that year. Unfortunately, through testing in the area, we did find four additional herds, which led to the USDA, the federal government, very involved in this process, and the USDA basically dropped state statuses, which term places restrictions on the export of cattle out of the state of Minnesota, which require individual testing of animals, which is at great expense. So we became very aware of the role that the federal government plays in this, and also in terms of the status drops. And what we were dropped to, we went from TB-free to what they call modified accredited advance, which, like I said, placed restrictions in terms of export of cattle. That same year, in 2005, obviously we always have worries when we find disease in domestic livestock that we have to be concerned about what's happening in the wildlife population. So that year we did begin surveillance with in the wildlife in the fall of...
Excuse me, Commissioner Martin, I just want to remind people to turn off their cell phones. It is interfering with the acoustics in here, so if you could do that, appreciate that. So, thank you. Please continue, Mr. Martin.
Like I said, that year we did start surveillance of white-tailed deer population, and unfortunately we did find infected deer. So we knew that we had a problem because it was in our domestic livestock and the wildlife. That brings us to the fall of 2006. We did a lot of additional testing of cattle herds, and we found two additional deep cattle herds. And then that also that year we did find additional deer infected. As you can see, things sort of started to ramp up as we found more and more of a persistent problem. In a response to that, we needed to get a handle on, was this problem isolated in this area or was this statewide? Accordingly, we conducted statewide surveillance of all cattle herds. We picked herds across the state to test, and also we tested deer statewide. Those results came back that the problem was isolated to a smaller area in northwest Minnesota, which was good news. Unfortunately, that same fall in 2007, we found four additional beef cattle herds, and that's what really set this really aggressive chain of events in motion, because we're only allowed to find so many herds in a period of time, and this goes back to the USDA dropping status levels, and because we found those four herds in the fall of 2007, we dropped yet another status, which placed some very intense restrictions on the movement of cattle out of the state, and we send over 200,000 head of feeder cattle out of the state every year. So basically, to get those cattle out of the state, they needed a test, which ranges in between $10 to $20, so things start adding up pretty quickly. So, and then I guess also coupled with that, we knew that we needed to be more aggressive, so that's when we saw last year really more aggressive action in terms of reducing the deer population, and Dr. Carstensen will talk about that a little bit later. That's sort of the history which led up to when this issue was placed before the committees last year, and you heard a lot about this and the TB bill. And just as an overview of what was in that bill, and which basically allowed the agencies to respond the way they did, is a main component was for a herd buyout program for a select number of herds really in the core area that were exposed to the wildlife population that would have potentially infection. And the legislature provided $3.35 million in that program, and that was a buyout program, and also for those who decided to stay in production to do fencing. And then also the other authorization was $472,000 in fiscal year 08 and $2.172 million in 09 for the Board of Animal Health to basically do the administration enforcement activities that they were going to need to do to basically enforce the movement restrictions in the area. We also provided the board additional authorities to implement the strategy. We provided the direction to the board to pursue the split state status. I'm sure many of you have heard about that. That has subsequently been achieved. That's something granted by the USDA, where we've been able to sort of focus all of our resources and attention on a smaller area and get the rest of the state to somewhat back to business as usual, but we're not entirely there. And then also that there was a property tax credit for the herd owners in the area. And then also we instituted a per head cattle assessment this year, which we are currently collecting from cattle sales, that will help pay for some of this effort. With that, that concludes my introductory remarks. If there isn't any questions, that Dr. Hartman will fill in sort of the blanks on the herd buyout fencing and where we're at with split states.
Thank you, Commissioner Martin. Any questions for the Assistant Commissioner before we move on? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. How long will the assessment of the dollar a head assessment be assessed against our producers, cattle producers?
Mr. Martin.
Chair, members, it's written into the statute. It is 1 year. It is January 1 of this year to December 31, and then it will terminate.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. And Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the invitation and members. The first thing I want to do, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and State Veterinarian. The first thing I wanted to do was thank all of you for your work last session. In the Senate, we did the same sort of presentation, and one of the senators called this good government. I was real pleased to hear that. This authority that you've given to the Board of Animal Health and the resources have been successful early in our fight to get rid of TB, so we appreciate that. Two things we wanted to accomplish on the livestock side. The first was, as Commissioner Martin said, attain split state status. That was really crucial for the export of our cattle outside of Minnesota. And we also realized there was no sense in testing a lot of cattle down in Rochester and Lanesboro and the southern part of the state. We had already done surveillance there and found that there wasn't any disease there, so we wanted to focus our resources and efforts up where we knew there was disease. We wanted to make sure we could contain the disease there and eventually eliminate it from that area. So with unlimited resources, you might continue to spend a lot of time in the southern part of the state, but with limited resources, you need to focus where the disease is. After attaining this status, which was granted in October of this of 2008, we have to now maintain those two different zones. And I have a handout that you should have in your packet. And on the front of it, you can kind of follow along with what I'm talking about. And then on the back of it is a map. And what that map shows is the majority of Minnesota is a modified accredited advanced zone, and then there's a small area in northwestern Minnesota that remains modified accredited. In that modified accredited zone, we're required to maintain the split state status to test all of the cattle, bison, goat, and farm cervidae herds there annually. We've done a lot of work this fall to get all of those herds tested. They all have been tested and are up to date right now. And there are 348 herds in that area and about 18,000 animals. So there was a lot of testing. And the good news is that we didn't find any additional infection in all of that testing that we did in that area this fall. Those herds now will, once we're done with the testing, they will all need a wildlife risk assessment, and we're going to be working on that soon. And once that wildlife risk assessment is done, each of those herds will have a herd plan. And what we're trying to provide is, even though these owners aren't in an area where we've found infected deer before, there is a chance that one might wander out there, so we're going to give them advice on how to keep the deer away from the stored feed that they have in the winter feeding areas for their cattle. In addition to that, then, we're going to be monitoring the movement of all this livestock into the zone, within the zone, and out of the zone. Big job. There's a lot of cattle movements in that area. Then in the MAA zone, or the Modified Accredited Advanced Zone, we'll be required to do some surveillance for TB, and we've already started that. We ask for volunteers at first, and then there's some mandatory testing that will be required around the modified accredited zone, outside of it, but around it. The second thing that we wanted to do in addition to attaining that split state status is go back to this management zone, and if you look again at this map that I provided, it's this outer kind of jagged circle. That's the management zone. And what's key there is that's the area that DNR has found infected deer, and so we want to make sure that there may be infected deer still there. We want to make sure that the farms that are in that area, first of all, that we get as many cattle out of that area as possible, and then the farms that remain, that there's not this interaction between cattle and deer and the feed. So to accomplish that, we've done two things. One is to offer this voluntary herd buyout, and in that buyout, there were 68 herds in this area that were eligible for the buyout. 46 of them signed contracts, and that amounts to approximately 6,200 head of cattle that will be removed from that area. And if you remember in the law, the deadline for having all the cattle off of the farms was January 31st of this year, which is this weekend. And so by this weekend, all of the cattle will be out of it, of these 46 herds will be out of the area. In this buyout, we did find one herd that sent some cows to slaughter, and three of them showed up infected. And that just really underscores the importance of this buyout. This is an area that we've found infection before in cattle, and the importance is to get the cattle out of this area. Now, for those 22 herds that remain in that management zone, we want to be very careful that we're keeping the deer and the cattle separate, And the main thing that we want to keep separate is the storage feed and then the winter feeding areas for the cattle. What we've done is done a risk assessment on all those premises, and if they were deemed, if it was deemed that they needed fencing, they were required to put up fencing around their storage feed and winter feeding areas. That project is all done. There were 27 premises that needed fencing. It was a 90-10 cost share with the producer, and there we put in about 71,000 linear feet of fencing. So I haven't been up there since the fencing has been put up, but it should be a pretty interesting thing to see. So really, we've completed the split state status, we've completed this buyout, and we'll complete it this weekend, and we've completed the fencing. So things are going extremely well. We haven't found any new infection, and again, I just want to thank you for all the support you've given us in this effort. It seems to be working.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. Any questions for Dr. Hartman? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Hartman. Dr. Hartman, I understand that it's a period of three or four years after all the critters are gone, and before these diseases are dead and cattle could be safely introduced again. First of all, is that accurate? And secondly, maybe just expound on that if you would.
Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, we feel like in the herds that we've had infected for TB, that if we go onto that farm and clean and disinfect the premises and allow it to stand for a month, that you can put cattle back on. And that's what we have done with infected herds. with these herds in the management zone, really the issue is the deer. It's very difficult. I don't envy DNR their job in trying to make sure that all the deer are free of this disease. It's a difficult thing. So we're concerned there may be still infected deer there, and that's the concern for not allowing cattle back in this area. I didn't mention that, but this buyout is in place, and these people can't bring cattle back into this area until the whole state is TB free.
Thank you. And as far as the how other animals are affected, we know that cattle and deer are both affected by this, but I remember learning that it could even be transmitted to people, actually. Are there other animals that could be infected or this could be transmitted to? And if so, has anything been done to check to see if there's been any TB in those populations?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. It's a disease that primarily affects cattle. In Minnesota and Michigan, it has affected deer. And in Michigan, they've shown that it can affect a lot of other animals, too. Predators, they found it in a lot of different animals in the wild there. We don't think those are reservoirs for it. They're dead-end hosts, and so we're not as concerned about those. And again, it can affect any warm-blooded animals, so it can affect goats, bison, farm cervidae, other animals. And the ones that we can test, we are testing for. And our experiences they've had in Michigan is the only two things they think are of concern are the cattle and the deer.
Okay. And is it more easily transmitted to certain animals or from certain animals? Is that why you find that it's a dead end in some cases, but in other cases it can result in a spread?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It is easiest transmitted in cattle. That's why it's been a cattle disease over the years. Recently we found that deer are fairly susceptible to it and also an issue. Oh, and I forgot to answer your question about people. Yes, people can get the disease. We haven't had any problems with that in Minnesota. In Michigan, they've only had, I think, two incidences where they've had people get this bovine TB, and in one case it was because a hunter gutted a deer, he cut himself, and he got a local infection with it. And Michelle, helped me out. What was the other one?
I think the other one was an elderly gentleman that had complications. And after they identified his main problem, they found TB had been latent in his system as well.
Yeah. But if you go back to the history of the disease in the United States when it was very prevalent in cattle, as much as 5% of our cattle population was infected with the disease. It was dairy cows that had it that were, it was being passed in the milk. And if the milk wasn't pasteurized, then children could get the disease. That was fixed once we started pasteurizing milk.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hartman, in your opinion, was this past fall's feeder cattle run affected by the split state status, and do neighboring states such as North Dakota, Wisconsin, still accept cattle from Minnesota now?
Commissioner Martin?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in terms of market impact, we did get a lot of those questions, and we were very concerned about the potential market impact last year when we were looking at this, and we get a question quite a bit as well, what has been the economic impact of CD, and I can't tell you the exact loss, but I can tell you that we monitored markets really closely this fall on the feeder cattle, and while there were some discounts, that I think that you couldn't attribute it directly to potentially us being a CD state. So I think the markets held up. You brought up the point of state recognition of split state status, and it is up to the other states to individually recognize it. The state of North Dakota and the state of Wisconsin have not recognized it. That's not good news, but however, the good news is that those two states are not destinations for our feeder cattle. Our primary destinations for feeder cattle are Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota, which all recognize split state status.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we'll move on to next on the list. We have Dr. Michelle Carstensen from the DNR. Welcome, and I know you had, I know Dr. Hartman had said that he didn't envy your position, and having to deal with the deer population, a little easier to test a contained population of cattle than it is the deer, but if you would proceed, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Michelle Carstensen. I'm a wildlife health program coordinator with Minnesota DNR, and I have a brief PowerPoint brought along to share with you, as well as a handout that has this presentation in it as well, to bring you up to speed on the wildlife side of this disease. The first slide I have just depicts this area, and again, it was shown in the map that Dr. Hartman provided, but this just shows you where we have the infection in cattle, cattle and deer, but in deer, particularly in this slide to date, we've had 24 deer that we have found infected with bovine tuberculosis since we started looking in 2005. And they're confined to this small area in northwest Minnesota. We call it the TB Core. It's 164 square miles. And we've tested annually since 2005, and it seems that the disease is not increasing in prevalence, or the distribution isn't spreading. And I'll talk a little bit about that as we continue. There's really two main tools that we have as far as wildlife managers to try to combat diseases to get into wild populations. The first one is trying to reduce deer densities. There's a variety of ways that you can go about doing that. Special hunts and the use of sharpshooters or trained deer removal experts, as well as empowering landowners to remove deer on their property are some of the main ways. We also did a special aerial gunning operation I'll be talking about shortly. And the second component is really trying to minimize the risk of this disease being spread among wildlife or wildlife to cattle, as Dr. Hartman was talking about in that interface between cattle and deer. On the wildlife side, if we also prevent commingling of wildlife in artificial sense that happens during feeding operations, recreational type feeding, that can help reduce our risk of disease transmission. So we instituted a ban in late 2006 on the recreational feeding of deer and elk in about a 4,000 square mile area that encompasses our whole modified zone. And that was aimed at trying to reduce this risk of deer and elk being fed and congregating so that disease can be transmitted among animals. And the last thing is really disease monitoring and surveillance to continue our efforts to try to understand how this disease is persisting and if it is in our white-tailed deer population, and offering supplemental sampling opportunities to landowners and continued targeted deer removal operations. As I mentioned, we did a pretty extensive operation last winter that involved both ground sharpshooting and aerial gunning of deer in the TB Core area where we found the infections to date. We did do some sharpshooting in winter 2007 as well from the ground, moving over 500 animals, but we really increased our intensity this past winter. With that project, we removed about 546 deer with the ground sharpshooting, and this map shows the locations of those deer that were removed, and an additional nearly 400 were removed through an aerial gunning operation, which is shooting deer from helicopters. In addition to that, we increased the abilities of landowners to remove animals in a much larger area, all the way from the southern portion of our TV surveillance zone to the Canadian border, and they removed 125 additional deer. All of these animals were sampled for bovine TB, and we did find 6 of those cases to be confirmed positive, again restricted to that core area. But we reduced the population, we believe, through this effort by possibly 90% along those lines, through this intensive effort. This, again, is a lot of animals being removed in a short amount of time, and we made all efforts to sample all the animals as well as provide carcasses for human consumption that did not look like they had any obvious signs of disease. So we gave out about 90% or so of the animals that were removed to local folks that had interest in the deer. So most of the venison was salvaged, which was another win-win for at least acceptance of this project, especially at the local scale. Through the years, we've tested all age classes of deer, too. I wanted to point that out, so it wasn't just older animals that we were targeting. This is important because when you're looking at the younger age classes, the fawns and yearlings, if we find animals that are that young that are infected, it could be an indication that this disease is persisting in the population. So it's important to test those animals so you have a sense of where the infection is and in what age structure. And we have this theory we call the Live in 05. And what that means is of the cases that we've had confirmed positive, all 24 deer would have been born in 05 when this started, or on the ground. So we haven't found any new infections in younger deer, which would again indicate that we might have deer-to-deer transmission occurring or at a level that could be persisting this infection in wildlife. So it's a very positive sign that it's been older animals, and we haven't seen positive infections in younger animals as we continue our surveillance. Dr. Hartman talked about fencing, and I just want to make a point, too, that managing the steer-cattle interface is a very important component of trying to combat this disease from both the wildlife and the domestic cattle front. Also, as an agency, we did a few things to try to allow our hunters to take a more active role in helping us reduce deer populations in this area. And one of the things we did was to create a special deer hunting permit area, referred to as Permit Area 101. And when we created this special area, it encompassed all of the infected deer that we had to date, and it allowed hunters to receive additional permits at a reduced cost, $2.50 for a special disease permit to take an unlimited amount of deer.
And I could interrupt just for a moment just to remind members and people in the audience as well to turn off their cell phones and Blackberries, or because, again, it's interfering with the audio. So thank you. Please continue.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. And we also increased the hunting opportunities in permit areas that surrounded this Permit Area 101. So it's not just one spot where we're allowing the taking of more deer. We opened it up to a wider area. So because deer can obviously spill in from a distance into an area that have a lot removed. So this allowed hunters to take up to 7 deer in permit areas that are shown in this map as green that allow intensive management as well as an early hunt. So again, this helped encourage more deer to be taken in this area that we could test. And this past fall, we just completed another round of hunter harvest and surveillance, and we tested approximately 1,250 or so deer. And I'm happy to report that preliminary results did not show any signs of any clinically infected animals. And this is in contrast to previous falls where we did have infected animals showing up at our check stations that had lesions consistent with the disease, and we could tell those signs. The testing isn't completed as far as the final laboratory confirmation on the fall samples, but early indications are that we didn't find any additional infected animals this fall, which is very positive news. This is just finally a summary slide to show you how much surveillance that we've done. Mr. Martin talked about the statewide surveillance that occurred in cattle in 06, and we did do statewide surveillance of deer also in 06, testing approximately 4,000 deer outside of this area in northwest Minnesota. But to date, in the northwest, we've tested over 5,000 deer, and again, we've had the 24 cases I talked about in the beginning. So far from this past fall, we haven't seen any additional infection, and now we're right now poised into starting another deer survey. It's probably going to occur next week, and that again is going to count the number of deer remaining in this core area and help set the stage for another intensive deer move effort that we're expecting to start in February, which will include both ground sharpshooting and an aerial gutting operation to try to remove remaining animals in this area and have them tested to see if there's still infection out there. We also plan to continue our enforcement of the recreational feeding ban and keep pressures on deer this coming hunting season through liberalized hunts and special permits like we've been doing the last couple of years. And finally, just to continue coordinating all of our work with Board of Animal Health and NDA and USDA as we move forward and try to combat this disease. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Carstensen. With the proximity to the border, what's your coordination with the Canadians on this? And do you share information? Are they doing any surveillance with your population? And just maybe some background on that.
Sure, Chair. We do communicate with our neighbors to the north. We have an annual meeting. We get together and talk about disease issues, and TB is obviously one of them, as Manitoba has an infection of bovine tuberculosis in wild elk quite a bit north of where we're working in Minnesota. So bovine tuberculosis has been in their course of work for quite some time. At the border, there has been some surveillance in deer the first year that we found it. So we found it in 05, and then that following fall, which was at fall 06, they did some voluntary testing of hunter-harvested deer at the border. The samples were not extensive. They probably had less than a couple hundred animals that they tested. They didn't find any infection. But they haven't been concerned enough, I guess, to do any sort of mandatory testing of late as they monitor where our infection is and they don't see a northern movement of infected animals outside the core. I think that would be a trigger for them to do some additional surveillance in deer. But as far as I'm aware of, they haven't done any surveillance at the border since 06.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Then, are we checking anything coming in, being brought back into the United States?
Dr. Carstensen.
Chair and committee, we're not, I guess, actively looking for testing TB that's being, carcasses brought across the Canadian border. We have import restrictions for things like chronic wasting disease, which we'll be talking about next, but we don't have anything where animals are tested. I don't know how sensitive that is.
Okay. Well, it brings up an interesting issue. The deer, tend not to recognize our borders very well, and as far as the spread of it, I think of Michigan, for instance, as it stayed relatively contained there, even though it got spun out of control for them, not spreading beyond their own borders and into other states. I'm just wondering how far it normally spreads before, I guess, it peters out, or can it continue to spread throughout the country if it's not contained in one spot?
Mr. Chair and committee, I think that's an important factor, and that is how much of an infection you have when you first discovered it. In Michigan's case, when they first were aware they had an infection in wildlife, they had over a 5% prevalence in the local deer herd, and that's quite a contrast to our prevalence, which was less than 0.5% when we first detected it. So they had a larger infection in a broader scale, and it included over four counties. So they had a bigger job to tackle as far as trying to control the spread. And most of their infections have occurred in that four-county area that they focus their efforts on. They have had a few dispersing animals pop up as positive, but not a persisting infection in those areas. So I think the disease can spread. It typically spreads more with seasonal movements of deer and within their home ranges. And deer can migrate, and they do migrate, but they migrate typically less than 10 miles. In most cases, so extensive movements from infected animals isn't likely, but there can be diseases that that can pop up in different areas. But persisting in those areas is really the main thing that people are concerned about and working towards.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. As you were talking about the deer removal project, I thought I heard you say that 90% were given out to folks for food, and if that's correct, that sounds good. Can I assume you did not use lead shot?
Dr. Carstensen?
Mr. Chair and committee, in winter, this past winter, there was lead shot used This was prior to the discoveries that was made in more recent times now of concerns about lead. This coming project this winter, we did specify non-toxic shot for our aerial contractor, and the Wildlife Services, which is a division of USDA that does the ground sharpshooting and did all the removal last winter with us in the ground, did not at that time use non-toxic shot, but they've now they're going to do that this winter too.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I'm just wondering, what is the estimated percentage of the deer herd? Do we have a number here of the totals of the deer that were tested? What do you think the percentage of the total deer herd that was, and how much is still left out there of the deer herd?
Dr. Carstensen.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I think talking about what we sampled during the fall hunter harvested, I think we sampled approximately 70 or so percent of available deer that are brought in to be registered that are harvested, so they're adult animals. So that's probably about the amount that are sampled that are available to us during the hunting season. We talk about what we sampled in the core area during the targeted removal operations. In the first winter, we sampled, and I think we removed approximately 50% that first winter. And then this past winter, given our aerial survey results, we think we harvested more like over 90%. We counted approximately 800 deer in the core last January. This would have been of 08. And we removed, over 900 animals. So given the variation in that estimate, we think we removed nearly 90% or greater from the core at that time.
Representative Duskowski.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Carstensen, what does the future look like? At what point do you realize that, we've got it licked?
Mr. Chair, committee, we have a memorandum of understanding that we signed with the United States Department of Agriculture along with the Board of Animal Health, and in that agreement we committed to doing ongoing surveillance annually in deer for at least 5 years past the time we don't find any new infections in deer. So that's I think the minimum time frame we're looking at right now is 5 years out. And I think that may change if we have additional infection or things change in the landscape. But right now, that if we stay negative and we don't find any additional deer, I think we would be slowing down or tailing back anyway our surveillance efforts after that time when we would think that the disease is no longer out there at a detectable level.
And Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, excuse me. Outside of the core area, how many deer do you think are still out there that you haven't been able to sample, obviously? I'm just wondering, because it seemed like when we make a trip through that area, granted it was prior to this year's hunting season, when one would go through the area that you thought there were, I'd heard there were already many deer were shot. We saw a lot. And I'm just wondering, what the percentage is out, beyond that core area, what the size of the deer herd currently is out there.
Dr. Carstensen.
Mr. Chair and committee, I don't have, an exact number to report on that question. In that area, that part of the state is kind of a transition zone between the forested area and agriculture. And it typically has about 6 to 8 deer per square mile on average, randomly distributed through the landscape. And if we did a rough population estimate of our TV surveillance area a few years back, and we thought we had about 15,000 animals or so available to us in that surveillance zone. We haven't looked at that again real recently. We've been focusing quite a bit more on numbers in the core, where we're trying to focus all of our removal and our removal operations. And as I mentioned, we did do some aerial work the last two winters that preceded our deer removal work on the ground, and we counted approximately 1,000 deer the first year in the core itself, which is a 164 square mile area, and then about 800 last year, and we're going to be counting this week, again, this coming week, to see if all of this additional removal as well as all the hunting has had a effect that we can now just say is significant on reducing those numbers. But clearly there's deer in the surrounding area that you know, haven't been as affected by the removal operation, and they're free to move in. It's a fluid environment. There's no movement barriers around the core. But we hope we had a significant decrease, at least in that small area up here.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, I would like to thank you all for what you've done. I think it's a good example of how we can have departments working together to head off a very serious threat to our state. For all three, the Department of Agriculture, the DNR, and the Board of Animal Health, thank you very much. And next we'll be moving on to another disease which is a potential threat in Minnesota, and it's being monitored, chronic wasting disease. And I don't know if there's things that we could learn from what happened with the issue of the bovine TB to be applied here. We are going to hear again from Dr. Carstensen on this, as well as Dr. Paul Anderson from the Board of Animal Health. So thank you for joining us, and please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'd also like to talk to you a little bit today, too, about chronic wasting disease. I have, again, a brief presentation for you and handouts that I've provided for this talk. First, I wanted to spend just a couple minutes talking about what chronic wasting disease is, just in case there's folks in the room that haven't been faced with this disease lately or thinking about it. So a quick refresher is in order. And it's a slowly progressive brain disease that affects deer, elk, and moose. It belongs to the family of diseases known as transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or prion diseases, and it's not caused by a traditional type of disease vector like viruses and bacteria. It's instead caused by a misshapen protein that can replicate in the system. This disease is challenging because it's non-traditional, and it has basically a neurological presentation in the animals that it affects. These types of signs are dementia, incoordination, circling. Animals are seen drooling. They have a loss of fear to being approached by people that they normally would have. There is no treatment for this disease that is always fatal. There's also no immune response that are offered by the host, so that also makes having a vaccine or any sort of diagnostic tool for a live animal very difficult. Typically, this disease is diagnosed once the animal has died. There is some work in rectal biopsies and tonsil biopsies that's promising, but the true diagnostics required in animals has been dead and take some postmortem samples. It's also difficult to inactivate the infectivity of this agent because it's unconventional, and it's spread primarily animal to animal, although there is evidence that this disease can persist in the soil and have the ability to reinfect animals years after infected animals are removed from that environment. So that adds another component of challenge to this disease. We do know a few things about CWD, and there's been quite a bit of research in recent years. We do know that it accumulates in the gut and retroperitoneal lymph nodes and OVEX portion of the brain, as it's a neurological disease. Finding it in the brain is often what we look for. It takes quite a bit of time for this disease to cause an effect. It's an average of 16 months before they show signs of the disease, so it's a very chronic disease. It has limited infectivity in the body. There has been recent study to indicate prions can be found in muscle, and that's a newer finding. I think there's some migration of prions in the muscle tissue, but so far it's only known to affect white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, and more recently discovered moose. There's no evidence at this time that it affects other animals, and there has not been a clear link to any sort of human cases of the more Jacob Putzfeldt disease that's more in line with CFE. I just have a map to show that it has the current state of affairs of North America here and where this disease is found in the U.S. The gray shaded states and provinces indicate that it had some infections in captive areas, and you'll see Minnesota has a 2. The more recent number there would be 4. Also, there's been a recent finding of a positive in a captive facility in Michigan, so that also would be on there. But the red area indicates where this infection is in wild deer or elk or moose in the U.S. So bringing us back here to Minnesota and what's our response been as far as surveillance and then prevention from this disease getting into our borders. One thing, of course, to do is monitor the wild deer herd, and I'll talk a little bit about the surveillance that we've been doing, and then preventing this disease from being able to come in. To accomplish these types of efforts, they have to coordinate among agencies, such as the Board of Animal Health, which does regulate the captive servant industry, you can hear about in a little while, and other stakeholders out there. We do targeted surveillance of all quote-unquote sick deer, and what that is that that's deer that exhibit clinical signs of disease that would be consistent with chronic wasting disease, as I mentioned already, in coordination, salivating, emaciated, and things like that. They're always tested for CWD. We've also conducted statewide surveillance for the disease, and then some more targeted surveillance I'll talk about in a little bit. Planning for any sort of response if it is found in our state has been things we've been working on. And again, we also try to import, restrict the importation of carcasses of deer, moose, or elk from areas that have the infection endemically, such as moving an attacked animal across the border that was harvested out of state. There's regulations on what they can bring in and how that has to be prepared. Just a brief history of our exposure to this disease in Minnesota is we did have two cases of chronic wasting disease found in captive facilities in 02, an elk in Aiken County, and then another elk in Stearns County, and that was the start of our statewide effort we did trying to see if we have any infection in wild white-tailed deer. So from 02 to 04, we sampled about 28,000 deer statewide, looking for this disease if it was prevalent in a deer herd at a rate of 1% or higher. And through all that testing, we did not find any positive animals that were wild animals in Minnesota. Since that time, we've scaled back our statewide effort and actually focused more on testing animals that are sick or that have any signs of disease. And we've also looked at other risk factors that would indicate some more extensive testing would be required. And in fall of 06, we did some additional surveillance for chronic wasting disease, and it was more sparked by another discovery of a captive positive in a white-tailed deer in Lac-La-Parr County. We wanted to make sure there hadn't been any spillover into the wild deer, so we did surveillance in that area, and we were also doing statewide bovine tuberculosis surveillance at the same time. So since we were already working at stations, we collected samples for chronic wasting disease at the same time, and we tested approximately 1,260 deer through that effort and did not find any infections. And then most recently, this past fall, we did again some surveillance for chronic wasting disease in conjunction with bovine tuberculosis surveillance in the Northwest. And we also looked at stations that are on our border, as Wisconsin has this disease in free-ranging deer. They're a high-risk factor as far as proximity to our border. So we looked at some deer, approximately 450 deer along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border, and did not find any, at this point, positive for the disease, although final testing on all those samples is not quite available yet. So just a brief summary of where we go from here. As I mentioned, we did the statewide surveillance in 02 to 04, and we're not poised right now to repeat that extensive type of sampling for now. Again, we're focusing on sick animals and spending our resources where we think we have some indication of illness in the population, and that's again trying to test all the sick animals that that get reported to us. These type of sampling efforts would increase if our risk factors change. One of those again would be if we find any infection in captive servant industry, and at this point we now have had four introductions of CWD into a captive situation. I already talked about three of them. We have a more recent one we just was announced last week that the board that we'll be talking about here with Mr. Anderson, a little bit more detail. We had a recent elk farm that found infection in Olmsted County. So this would be our fourth time that we've had infection in a captive herd. Also, I mentioned Wisconsin has free-ranging wild deer that wild deer that are infected, and we also have there is infection in South Dakota also. So at our borders, we're monitoring the surveillance that those states are doing and seeing if there's any elevated risk to Minnesota and if stepping up surveillance is required at that point. And again, the import restrictions I mentioned, this map just shows the areas that are restricted for movement of game across into our borders. The meat has to be butcher dressed, and they can't bring along any spinal column and brain tissue, and so it has to be clean air and that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Dr. Representative Ordunius.
In terms of your import restrictions, what I'm hearing is it's just dead animals, but you allow
live animals to come in from restricted areas or from areas that are infected?
Dr. Christensen.
Mr. Chair and Committee, yeah, I was referring to the wild, to the game part of this. I'm going to let Mr. Anderson talk about the import restrictions on the captive industry because the board regulates that. So he'd like to answer that.
Dr. Anderson, if you could please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm a veterinarian with the Board of Animal Health, and I have been involved with the farmed cervidae industry since 2002. And representative, we do have very strict import requirements on live animals. And what our statutes say is that in these areas like Colorado, Wyoming, where we consider CWD to be endemic in these animals, we allow no importation of live animals from those areas at all, nor do we allow from southern Wisconsin or the newer areas in the country where CWD has been found in the wild. So we're very strict about what we allow to come in, and we require that if we bring in live animals from a herd that's not in an area that's considered endemic, they have to have participated in a CWD surveillance program for their herd for at least 3 years. So we're pretty particular about what we let into Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. And if I could remind people to turn off their cell phones and BlackBerries, please. And Dr. Anderson, I think you could continue if you wish, or Dr. Carstensen, were you through?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Anderson. Excuse me, I guess there is one more question over here. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Anderson, first of all, I like your name. Anyway, just out of curiosity, you mentioned that the disease takes a long time to incubate, about 16 months. And we've had 4 cases in this state. How can you tell when the exposure actually occurred?
Maybe I'll take that one, Mr. Chair and committee members. With these chronic diseases where there are extremely long incubation periods, and I know in elk we consider that an incubation period can easily be up to 3 years. Some people would even maybe theorize a little longer. Oftentimes it's difficult, if not impossible, to figure out exactly when the exposure occurred. What we do kind of think, though, in elk and deer especially, is that if we have a clinically ill animal, we pretty much will accept that the animal is exposed within a 3-year period.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no other questions, please proceed, Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to talk about our farmed cervidae industry just a little bit. It's a very successful industry. We have about 650 producers in Minnesota right now that raise deer or elk or reindeer or other species of deer. And the rules that govern how these folks raise these animals were put in place during the legislative session 2003. And part of that legislation required that all of these folks do surveillance in their herds for chronic wasting disease. What they have to do is that any animal that dies on their farm or is sent to slaughter that's over 16 months of age has to be tested for CWD. We test about 3,000 animals from our farms every year. In total, we have about 17,000 to 18,000 elk or deer on farms in Minnesota on any given day. So we test about, the producers test about 3,000 of those a year. We did find an infected herd in Lacaufarl County in 2006. That was a sample that the producer collected as he was supposed to. And unfortunately, we found a herd just this last week. This herd happens to be a fairly large elk herd just north of Rochester in Olmsted County. Again, these animals were animals that were sent to slaughter. They were actually slaughtered at a kosher kill plant in Dawson, Minnesota, and the producers, as they were instructed to do, made sure that they collected all the brain stems and lymph nodes that they were supposed to, submitted them to our veterinary diagnostic lab here in Minnesota, where the initial diagnosis was made that one of those animals was infected. Those samples get sent down to the National Veterinary Services Lab in Ames for confirmation. And that sample, again, was confirmed to be positive on Friday last last Friday. That herd is now under quarantine. Nothing's allowed to leave that farm. Nothing's coming in. And we're just starting to work through the epidemiology on where this may have come from. So lots of details on that one yet to be discovered. But, you know, we keep telling everybody that our producers in Minnesota have been instructed to do this testing. They've been doing as they've been instructed, and unfortunately we found the disease again. Historically, these herds are generally euthanized, but issues of indemnity and those things are yet to be determined. We do have, as we said, we have very strict import rules. We also track all of our farmed animals. If producers move animals from farm to farm in Minnesota, we have record of each of those movements. We require inventories on our farm survey farms every year. And we actually have staff in our agency that inspect all these farms at least once a year, possibly more, to make sure that their fences are up to snuff. They all have to be 8 feet high. They have to be maintained. Their animals all have to be identified with ear tags, and they have to let us know what's going on with all those sorts of issues. So we've been involved extensively with the farm deer and elk industry, and right now we're dealing with another infected herd. So, Mr. Chair, that's my report.
Thank you. And it seems to me, with the bovine TB, I believe that it was, it's believed that it was cattle that were brought in which started the spread of the TB. I'm not sure if I'm correct in that assessment, but I believe that was the case, or that's at least believed to be the case. And in the case here again, we find once again with chronic wasting disease, it was actually animals that were imported from other areas of the country. Sounds like the threat maybe isn't so much in the wild animal herds and the spread coming into the state. Would that be a correct assessment, that maybe it's a greater threat, animals that are being imported into the state?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, looking at this last infected herd that we've discovered, there have been no animals that we know of that have left that herd or come into the herd within about the last 7 years. Now, the herd was established in the early 1990s, and we know that a lot of those animals were brought in from out of state. In those years, we weren't doing a whole lot of testing for chronic wasting disease, and mandatory programs, you know, became law in 2003. So we really don't know how long this herd may have been infected at a low level, and we don't know, you know, at this point exactly where the disease came from. But we have done surveillance. DNR folks have done a fair amount of surveillance, and I think some was done in Olmsted County just this last fall. We have no indication that we have wildlife with chronic wasting disease at this time. So we certainly will be looking back in the records of this herd and looking at, you know, sources of animals as they came in.
Okay, and yeah, and the point I was trying to make, it just sounds like it doesn't spread as much naturally. Again, it seems that there's the importation that bringing animals in from other states may have led to the beginning of the disease in the state. Next, Representative McNamara, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of them. Dr. Anderson, historically, haven't we killed the entire herd when we found an infected animal? And is there compensation for the farmer? And what's the state's current situation if we were to, I mean, this is a huge, huge herd. What will be the economic impact if we decide to take out the whole herd? And is this one, it seems to me they keep the animals separate down there. It seems like you see all the bull elk, but I'm sure they must intermingle them at some point, because if I'm not mistaken, it was a cow that's infected. Can you address some of those questions?
Sure.
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the animal that was found to be infected was a 7-year-old cow. She was born on the farm in 2001. We know that. This particular farm, we just finished an inventory yesterday and counted all the animals. There are 534 elk that remain on that farm. That's slightly less than we initially thought might be there, but we actually went out and did a head count with the owners. So 534 is what we think is there. They do keep the animals segregated. The bulls are generally, I don't know how many of you drive past that farm, but you can usually see a fair number of the bulls on the hill along Highway 52 as you drive past. And help me with your question again.
Well, the ones, if we could deal with them, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Anderson, what would be the cost if we were to take all 534 of them out?
We're in the process, and historically, the herds that we have found to be infected have been euthanized, all the animals. And what's happened in the past is that those animals were, the owners were compensated, indemnity was paid through funds from the federal government. So those funds come through USDA, Veterinary Services, that division. And we are talking to the USDA folks right now to try to find if there is indeed indemnity money available. We don't have the answer to that yet. We're also in the process of putting appraisal values on those animals to see what a dollar figure might be to compensate the owners for those animals. If those animals are euthanized, we would be obligated to pay the producer a fair market price for those animals. So we're working through those details at this point. The three herds that were, well, actually a couple more herds than that were depopulated in the past, those producers were all paid by the federal government.
And then, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Anderson, is there any chance, do they do a double sample or something? I'm just surprised with this large of a herd. They had to be testing all the time, because I know they're slaughtering animals down there all the time. And for one to pop up now, do we do some kind of a double sample so we recheck the sample to know that it was a positive?
That's Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we were very lucky in this particular instance because the Haney brothers who own this herd is now owned by Tower Investments, a company out of California that's slated to develop this property near Rochester. They are thinning that herd down, and they elected to kill 179 animals at this plant in Dawson. And actually, they contacted us and asked for help, and we actually sent our staff out to the plant to collect all these samples, and we were very careful to actually collect all the ear tags and put the ear tags with the samples that were submitted to the diagnostic lab. So we're very sure what we have, that it was the right animal, and the samples the testing was performed at the diagnostic lab here in Minnesota and also in Ames to verify that indeed it was a positive sample. Now, Haney's have tested, we looked back over the last 5 years, they've tested 380 animals on that farm. So they have been doing a lot of testing. Now, why did we find one now? That's kind of the big question. Could there be a very, very low prevalence of chronic wasting disease in this herd? It's a possibility. We're sorting that out. We're trying to find out if there were any animals over the years that might not have been tested, that might have been missed along the way, and those details, we just don't have them all yet.
One final question. Mr. Chair, Dr. Anderson, just a ballpark, how much money would this be talking, would we be talking about for a herd this size? And has the USDA ever not compensated a state for wiping out a herd?
Mr. Chair and committee, if we have 500 animals and they're worth, let's just say they're worth $2,000 a piece, just as a very wild guess. We can do the arithmetic, but I think that comes to about $1 million, roughly. They could be worth more than that. Some of the animals certainly could be worth more than that. And what USDA, the way USDA and the Code of Federal Regulations reads is that USDA can compensate an owner up to 90% of an appraised value with a cap at $3,000 an animal. So we don't know where those animals will be appraised, but we're in the process.
The one part you didn't answer, do you know if USDA has ever not compensated the state?
Dr. Anderson?
I don't, you know, have all the details on that, but I know that we have asked the question to USDA and we've not gotten an answer yet because they do have to look for money and figure out if there's money available. Times right now are challenging financially for all of us, and we don't have the answer yet.
Okay. And I think we'll take one more question, then we have another disease. We also have to do VHS. So Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Dr. Carstensen, I think you said that once this elk was found, you did some spot checking of the deer around there. Did I hear that correctly?
No.
Mr.
Chair and Representative
Dr. Carstensen.
This herd was just detected last week.
Oh.
However, during the fall surveillance in November, we did surveillance along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border, and some of those samples were from Olmsted County, not necessarily exactly around this property, but in the vicinity. So it was probably less than 50 deer that were tested out of that county this past fall. But we're currently planning to do a survey of deer around this property probably this coming weekend. And might do some additional surveillance coming up in the hunting season.
Yes,
my basic question then is, what fund pays for this?
That's a question.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the primary funding source is Fish and Game dollars to a captive, a Wild Service Health account that we have. This was money that was originally earmarked for emergency feeding of deer, and now it can be used towards managing wildlife diseases and outbreaks. So we have a money that can be used towards the CWD type of work from this fund.
We're so short of money. Do the elk farmers participate and put money into this fund, knowing that we're going to have to do some survey work?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the elk producers and the deer producers in the state do pay an inspection fee that goes to the Board of Animal Health to offset some of the expenses of all the inspections we do, but I'm not aware that they pay into a wildlife account.
I mean, wouldn't that be appropriate since we have so little money and this is not something that general taxpayers can pay for anymore?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I know how to answer that question.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a fairly basic question. You are reimbursed to some extent. Would not it be appropriate for DNR to be reimbursed because they have to be checked? I mean, we have to check the deer population.
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I respect that the question was asked, but I'm not sure how to answer that. You know, I think that our folks from the DNR would be better positioned to answer that one.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we will be having next Roy Johannes from the DNR. Is he here? Okay, thanks.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and Committee. For the record, my name is Roy Johannes, and I'm with the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And as my computer's warming up here, we'll talk a little bit about VHS and the fatal fish disease that's been found in the Great Lakes. VHS, the disease has actually been around for about 40 years and originated in Europe. And the species that were primarily affected were trout and salmon species. And the disease came to the United States and was primarily found on the east and west coast. In 2005, the disease broke out into cool and warm water fish in the St. Lawrence Seaway. And since then, it has an expansion into the Great Lakes. You should have a handout today of my presentation that will get geared up here in just a moment.
While we're waiting for it to boot up, your Representative Hansen has a question.
As long as we're waiting, Mr. Vance, was there a report required about interagency working just on testing? Did that report get done and presented to the chair?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, the report was done and was provided to the chairs, and today's discussion was just an update on the surveillance that we have been conducting the last few years.
Representative Hansen.
Is it possible we could get copies of that report?
Mr. Johannes?
Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, we'd be glad to provide copies to you.
Thank you. It is also on the website for those who would be interested in looking it up. And while we're waiting here, we can have the VHS report emailed out as well. So we'll do that.
Okay. As the virus had fatal fish kills in the four Great Lakes, in October of 2006, USDA just took and put together a rule which required VHS testing for all interstate transportation in the Great Lakes, all eight Great Lakes states. That rule came in as kind of a shock to a lot of people that were raising fish in the Great Lakes states, since most of them that did not have trout and salmon species were not prepared for the testing that was required after that. In 2007, the Department of Natural Resources looked at developing plans for two vectors that we felt were very important as a way for VHS to enter the state, and that was Lake Superior and the Mississippi River, and we put together an action plan to do that. As we followed up and we had that action plan to get us through the spring of 2007, we put together a statewide action plan dealing with ways to deal with VHS from a pre-VHS standpoint, from a situation where VHS did come to the state, and what to do with the VHS as it had entered the state. We were also fortunate in 2007 to apply for and receive an APHIS grant for $97,000. During that time, we worked on legislation that was introduced last year and passed in the spring of 2008. And as we wrapped up our grant in 2008, we were also able to apply for a grant in 2008 and 2009, which we received for $154,000 for surveillance. During that time, we also did a report to the legislature, which we provided in January 5th 2009. Up to date, we've had no VHS reported in Minnesota. The Minnesota adopted the policy of the Great Lakes Fish Health Committee, and those rules were enacted in statute 1992. And this was primarily dealing with the testing of VHS for trout and salmon in the state. As you can see on the handout, we have a map of where the vectors are, where we feel that the Lake Superior and the Mississippi River, where we feel VHS will enter the state. In 2007, the spring of 2007, we began preparing our plan, and we looked at a couple of key factors. The first one is that we were taking walleye eggs from the St. Louis River. Now that we've caught up to the presentation.
Yeah, that'd be overhead. Leave it alone.
Oh, okay. In the spring of 2007, we looked at potential vectors for spreading VHS in the state. In the first place we looked was a walleye intake that we had at the St. Louis River. We, at that time, we eliminated that intake and moved the eggs that we took it there to our tower hatchery in Lake Vermilion. We discontinued use of salmon and salmonid reef at Prince River Hatchery for stocking in inland waters. We no longer use Prince River as a holding facility, and we eliminated the incubation of white suckers that we use for forage as muskies. And as I talked about, to develop the plan for 2007, we did an action plan to deal with VHS pre- as it arrives and post. We did do a presentation to aquaculture leaders in August of 2007 to prepare them for what could be coming up with VHS legislation. And the VHS legislation we prepared in 2007 dealt with the importation, stocking, transportation laws that would include all the VHS susceptible species. Those species were identified by USDA APHIS as either carrier species or fish that had died from fish kills in the Great Lakes. The additional rulemaking that we'll continue to work on will deal with bait importation, and that will be dealing with primarily processed bait such as frozen and processed shiners that may be coming from East Coast areas. Our 2008-2009 grant, we were able to test 89 water bodies and included recreational lakes and rearing ponds that were operated by the Department of Natural Resources. As we moved into our grant in 2008 and 2009, we were able to get a grant to do VHS surveillance on 64 water bodies. We were able to include 48 of those as private fish farms, and have been working with some of the private aquaculture people to test some of their waters for future transfer of fish in Minnesota. We also will be planning to upgrade some of our hatchery facilities to allow us to do additional testing, which I'll show some of the testing methods later on in the slide. To give you an update where we have found VHS, and this is kind of an important slide, if you look at, there was only 4 entries in 2008 for VHS, and as we talked about our vectors of entry, the Mississippi River and Lake Superior, you can see down towards the Chicago area, which the Chicago River and Illinois River flow into the Mississippi, that VHS has traveled pretty far into Lake Michigan to be a concern for one of our vectors. We also, if you look at the one scenario in Ohio, this is the first time that VHS has been found out of the Great Lakes watershed, which is the key. Now, a very interesting scenario occurred in Michigan in 2007 in Bud Lake and Inland Water. They detected VHS and had a very severe fish kill. And as they went back in 2008, they were not able to find any VHS in any of the fish that were found in the lake. So there's some really some good interesting mysteries that we are still yet to unsolve. In 2009, we're still in a pre-VHS mode, and we'll continue to take additional sampling for VHS in important spawn taking sites. We have 10 in the state. We'll require that we surface disinfect all of our eggs that are entering our hatchery. These are precautions that are taking place to prevent the disease from moving into our facilities. We'll also conditional additional testing of VHS on various life stages, and that includes fry, frylings, fingerlings, and adults and so on. Last year we did a pilot project on two of our intakes where we collected ovarian fluids, and we did those in lots of five fish per sample. And you can see as we took the eggs, we screened the ovarian fluids into a vial, which were sent to our pathology lab for testing.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Joyans, in that Michigan example with the mortality of fish, was that across species or was that just one species and or two species? What when they found the death there of those and they came back the next year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, in the scenario in Michigan, they had fish kills of various smallmouth bass and panfish species, and the following year they did not see any mortality.
Representative Hansen.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. So, but did they find the smallmouth and other panfish there, or did the disease wipe them out, and then the fish that were caught the next year were a different species?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the fish were found in populations that were lower in abundance than they had been prior to the fish kill, but not all of the fish did die as part of the VHS outbreak that they had in 2007.
Representative Hansen.
So the fish that survived didn't show up with any VHS, so that could show that if there's any infection, it's 100% mortality, and there may be some that are resistant.
Mr. Johannes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, in talking to the individuals that did the testing, they actually found that once the water temperature reached 21 degrees centigrade, or around 70 degrees Fahrenheit, that all the VHS that was prevalent in the lake was no longer found. So it has been identified as a cold water virus, and as the water temperatures warm up, that virus does succumb to the warmer water temperatures. Now, that doesn't mean that the virus could not be found in the basin yet in the future, and there still be potential for outbreaks, but they'll need to do additional sampling. Now, this year in Lake Erie, there was a research project that looked at yellow perch, and yellow perch, young of the year or the first year catch fish and yearling fish, the 1 year old fish, did not show any presence of VHS, but when the adult population was tested post-spawn, VHS was found in the population, although no fish kill was taking place.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on your first response with temperature, if temperature could be some type of control, when we talked about ballast water, we talked about movement of water between in boat wells, between fish, between lakes, or between bodies of water. Kind of the discussion on cost with ballast water with disinfection was really the chemicals, but temperature could be a potential solution. Is there any testing going on in the laboratory on trying to search out that hypothesis?
Mr. Johannes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, when we put out our brochure last year, we felt that hot water always had was an application as part of the killing of the virus. We believe that 160 degrees would definitely be a disinfection tool for live wells and other voting instruments that would be transferred around. We are not aware of any testing going on for temperatures that are lower than that lethal temperature.
Thank you. Please continue.
This particular slide deals with the VHS susceptible species that are found in Minnesota, and you'll see primarily game fish species and a number of the bullheads and soft ray fish. In discussions with other states and researchers, they found the number one susceptible fish to VHS has been the muskellunge. As I talked about agents for killing VHS, you know, hot water was one of the an important key for that. The virus is actually very fragile and can be killed with sunlight and drying within a few hours. UV light, UV sterilizers and hatcheries has been shown to work, like solutions of chlorine, and you know, the hot water is the key for killing the virus. Here's a quick look at the areas where we've done testing, and you can see some of the key lakes: Lake Mille Lacs, Leech Lake, Lake Winnebagoche, Upper Red Lake, and Lake of the Woods, Rainy Lake, Lake Vermilion, to give you an idea of the recreational waters we're concerned about the spread of this virus. With that, I'll be glad to take any questions.
Any other questions for Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just kind of joking over here, but this evidently wouldn't kill carp, huh?
Mr. Johanna.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, right now the list could be pretty dynamic and change, and carp could be affected, but right now they're not listed on the VHS susceptible list.
Representative Hansen. Yeah. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. You got me curious about that Michigan lake, and were there northerns in that lake?
Mr. Johannes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not sure about the complete community dynamics of if northern pike were found in that water body.
What got me thinking about that, you said, did I hear you right? You said muskie is considered the most susceptible?
That has been identified by researchers in the eastern part of the country, yes.
I just wondered if the Esox family was going to be within the lake, so thanks.
Any other? Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johannes, to date we haven't found any VHS in Minnesota. What is the future for this? Is there a plan to sunset this, or what can you tell us?
Mr. Johannes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Draskowski, right now we feel that the virus still has an opportunity to spread. We have a number of waterways that come to Minnesota, especially the Mississippi through the Chicago River, Illinois Sanitary Canal, and up the Mississippi through a major tributary of our state. We feel that we still need to take precautions, and although there's been a number of tests that are being conducted in Lake Superior, we've been fortunate enough not to have VHS in Lake Superior as well. We feel we still need to be on alert. We put into law last year ability to require testing for VHS for any importation of fish into private facilities. We're continually requiring it for our own needs to move fish around the state, and until there is either some better way to find out more about this form of the virus, which is called VHSV4V, we still need to be in a precautionary mode and be prepared to deal with it if it does show up in Minnesota.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Johannes, for your testimony, and the meeting is adjourned.